Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And this is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Kukumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
Fireworks. Don't muck about.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle. Monkey tennis?
Yup-salutely, yup-yup-yup-salutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn.
Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk. Nah.
Monkey tennis?
From the host house.
Keep it down, love.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
There is no greater pleasure than just seeing a bum smile.
Nick Holder.
I'm just going to have to stop you there. I have to tell you, this is just a fake.
And Tom Stab.
I'm not eating tramp soup.
So we are now going to be tackling the remainder of Alan's podcast series. And I am obviously your host. So we're coming live from the host's house. But we'll be covering we'll be covering Alan Partridge from the host house. Alan's first foray into podcasting. I mean, we've been at it for 4 years. What took him so long?
Trailblazers here.
Absolutely. So the way that we're going to run this series is that two episodes of The Oast House will be covered in each episode of Monkey Tennis. So today we will primarily be looking at episode one, subtitled Seldom, and we'll be looking as well at episode three, Dating. Perhaps somebody would like to explain why we're omitting episode two, Ramble.
I'm happy to cover that because essentially Ramble episode two was the audible preview that was available for a week. We thought that was episode one. Turns out it's actually episode two.
I think that pretty much
covers it.
Concisely put. But yeah, obviously we've already done an episode about that, so you can go back and listen at your leisure. So episode one, Seldom. Do we want to do a little bit of world building about where Alan is in the APU, what he's up to? I mean, I guess throughout this series, you find out a lot more of the detail about his life. It's a lot more behind the scenes than something like this time. Which I always love. I love to get the narrative detail and the kind of the background of him and his cast of characters.
Yeah, I think in terms of where he is in the APU, all we really know at this point in terms of if you're hitting play on it is that the BBC show, so This Time with Alan Partridge, has finished and he's moved house from, I assume, Denton Abbey into the Oast House. But as you hit play, you don't have too much more context than that. And I feel like it would be a bit of a spoiler to start giving away the bits that reveal themselves throughout the series. So I feel like that's where you are when you hit play.
Very true. I mean, I guess one thing that eagle-eyed listeners and viewers, I suppose, of the track listing might notice is that episode one is called Seldom. Those of you that have seen Scissored Isle, I believe, will know that that is the name of Alan's dog. Mm-hmm. So Seldom is still alive and well, and obviously you would then expect him to feature in this episode, and by God, he does.
Yep, he's alive and well and very angry.
Yeah. Nick, is it fair to assume at this point that any episodes in this series that feature Seldom are your favourites?
Yeah, I'll always be happy to hear a dog, be it naughty or angry, just being...
and this one's both.
Yeah, exactly. So any dog in the APU is good with me.
So I was somewhat blindsided by the opening of this episode, and I cycled through a few different things of what I thought was going on. Initially, it sounds like Alan's making a genuine call to the emergency services, so that was my first thought. Then it sounded to me like it was staged, but presumably the person on the other end of the line was an actor hired by Alan for the purposes of this, and then eventually it transpires that what he's calling a harmless bit of fun was actually a genuine hoax call that he's made to the emergency services to boost his podcast.
What I also enjoyed was that even the prank call is fairly incompetent. He doesn't really know what he wants. It's not even by a prank call standard a very good one.
I have to say, I did find it very jarring, the fact this is what technically is known as a cold open, isn't it? Because it's straight into the phone call. Like, when I first pressed play, I was like, have I pressed play on the wrong thing? Like, for just like half a second, you're like, what the hell is going on? Because you're getting police, what's your emergency, is the opening line of the whole series.
I wonder if in the APU, the reason he's done this is that he knows the popularity of true crime podcasts. And so when it comes to his own, he's like, open it with a call to the emergency services. You've got them by the Jaffers.
I'd also say I think this is one of the reasons why they probably didn't use this as the preview episode on Audible. Because you know the way they were selling that in terms of using your Alexa to access the episode. So I think if you're doing that and then the first thing is you hear police, what's your emergency? People are going to freak out.
I think that's actually a good point, because I did think to myself, just episode one to episode two, so Seldom, one we're talking about now, is a stronger episode. So I was like, wouldn't you play that one as your kind of, you know, marketing hook? But actually that makes a lot of sense when you put it like that, that people might be baffled that they phoned the emergency services by mistake.
Yeah, I mean, they could think that, yeah.
And also, episode two is a bit more world building than the first episode. So I wonder...
I'd agree, yeah.
Yeah, so I do wonder if maybe what is episode two in the running order was originally going to be one at some point and then they changed their minds, I don't know.
In essence, I'm sure we'll kind of get to this as we go through, but I think there are three reasons why episode two worked better than episode one to be episode one in terms of the first thing people heard. That makes loads of sense. One, you've got a cold open and it's a police line, so it's going to confuse people. Two, as we'll get to, it's 11 minutes into the show before you get the actual theme song and title and proper intro to the programme.
Yeah.
And three, I totally agree with you, Tom. I think episode two, Ramble, actually is a much better world-building episode and is a more fitting introduction to the concept of the podcast, I think.
Absolutely. And I mean, in true Alan style, we've seen a similar thing, especially in the books that he's written. He gets, I think, 10 and a half minutes into this episode before he's even explained the concept of the episode. Now, I mean, when we did episode one of Monkey Tennis, I think we spent 5 minutes explaining what we were going to do, and I thought that was a bit overlong. So 10 and a half minutes for him to get to the point is very typical of Alan. Also, the crank call to the emergency services, it's bad enough that he's made a hoax call, but it also is only sort of very vaguely related to what he then goes on to talk about, namely that the reason he's done this podcast is because people who are going to jump off a bridge, abuse children and women, all have helplines, but men who are attacked on Twitter, as he puts it, have no one. And so that's why he's calling the emergency services, to try and make the point that there's no emergency service for middle-aged public broadcasters that have been called a sissy 100 times on Twitter. And so effectively this podcast, as he lays it out, is his opportunity to speak directly to critics and to silence naysayers and to sort of set the record straight, because he feels like he's been slandered on social media.
Also, he clearly hasn't thought to use the block or report functions on social media.
Yeah,
that is an option available to him.
Basically, the only reason he's doing this podcast, he says in this episode, is because, obviously, as Adam says, people are sort of trolling him. It's to combat his sort of slights on his person and his personal brand as well. It's all from a viewpoint of trying to get work from other sources, that, you know, he's getting people slandering his brand. So, for example, two of the rumours that he addresses at the beginning are that he's been seen in Aldi and Argos. which are not Bran Partridge. Asda.
Yeah, both places that he absolutely would go, but crucially would not want to have been recognised in. Yeah, he describes those as hurtful and damaging. I also liked that he sort of put himself in the same bracket in terms of celebrities who've been targeted as John Lennon, who obviously was shot and killed, Gianni Versace, who was shot and killed, and John Prescott, who was hit with an egg.
Oh, I love that line, when he got egged and then battered the Burke. Amazing.
Oh, and another accusation that I really liked, because it pays a lot of attention to past Partridge, is not just that he's been seen in Asda and Argos, but also that he was in the local swimming baths doing wits, which, as we know from watching Alan swim, he is a weak swimmer. Yeah. And so probably, and I believe maybe later in this episode, or certainly later in the series, there's a reason that he's been training himself up to be a stronger swimmer. So, yeah, that's quite good.
Yeah, I do love the through line of Alan's obsession with swimming in this Gibbons era of the APU, because everything we actually see and hear of this love of swimming would indicate he's actually no good at swimming at all. So that is... always a fun gag.
Yeah.
There are a couple of other online rumours and hurtful things that have been said about him, that he's been seen bowling underarm, which is obviously scandalous. And I really enjoyed the last example he comes into, that his wing mirror clipped another car, which he has been described as definitive proof that Alan Partridge doesn't know the width of his vehicle. I really enjoyed the payoff there, that, you know, you think it might be about because he's effectively done a hit and run on a vehicle, or it's about dangerous driving, but no, it's about knowing the width of his car. That's what's hurt him about that he doesn't know his vehicle properly.
I believe him that he probably does.
That he does know the width of his vehicle.
I believe he's the sort of person that would either know it or would hate himself for having not found out yet.
I'm pretty confident he knows the dimensions of his vehicle, isn't he? I enjoyed that he undoes his own argument by admitting that he's taken pleasure from defaming people himself and amending Wikipedia pages. It's like...
That's a really good point. Within like 3.5 minutes in, he's basically admitted to being an online media troll at the same time.
Did anyone jot down some of the rumours that he started? Because they're absolutely brilliant.
I've got the list if you want it.
There are four big ones. Let's do it.
Yeah. Trevor McDonald has nits.
Yep.
Brian Ferry can't ride a bike. John Humphreys hung a rabbit from a tree, and Fiona Bruce doesn't brush her teeth.
I love these partly because I think it's just the play between kind of older, so respected broadcasters and musicians, and then the rumours are literally things you would make up when you were like six in the playground, when you're like, he's got nits, he can't ride a bike, she doesn't brush her teeth, like. But-
And also,
you're right, that's bang on, yeah.
They're so trivial, and let's face it, at one point, I'm sure all of us have had nits. I'm sure at one point we all couldn't ride a bike, possibly with the exception of hanging a rabbit from a tree, which has a darker tone to it.
We also have just before then, the first mention of High Noon. There's not a huge amount of narrative through line through the whole podcast. You'd probably say that High Noon is the main one.
Yeah, he's essentially, he or she is essentially a new character in the APU, really.
Yeah, I think you're right, Tom. That's probably the only narrative thread where you think there's perhaps a conclusion that the series is leading to. But I think we should probably try not to get too far ahead in terms of spoilers and what happens in the other 17.
Did everyone check the Twitter handle at High Noon?
Yep, couldn't find it.
Disappointing results. Oh, I mean, there is one, but it's there's nothing kind of fun to be gleaned from it, from what I could see.
It looks like a
Red Dead Redemption thing.
Yeah, like a handheld iOS Android game, which I'm surprised they chose a handle where there was obviously something there that they couldn't secure and put some stuff on, even if it was just a empty profile with an egg. Like it would have, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's
because people are obviously going to go and check it, aren't they?
Hmm.
We are.
We have. Yeah, everyone does that, right?
But no, it's a good point, because if you look at when we were doing research into this time, and we found a lot of the tweets that they used on the Digiwall were actually real tweets.
I mean, yeah, sort of posted by...
It's quite a surprise they haven't gone into that depth of this.
Posted by production staff and things, weren't they, when we looked into it?
I was going to say about the rumours, I don't know, did anybody fact check these at all?
No.
Whether Fiona Bruce brushes her teeth?
Well, I just went with the one that actually I could fact check, which was whether Brian Ferry can ride a bike or not. And I'm pleased to confirm that not only can Brian Ferry ride a bike, but I found an interview from 2005 where he talks about being 15 and dreaming of being a Tour de France champion. Sadly, though, my follow-up Google image search of Brian Ferry on a bike yielded no fruitful results.
For a second, then, I thought you were going to say not only can Brian Ferry ride a bike, but Brian Ferry ridden a bike. Alan explains, he does a bit of explanation why he's addressing these rumours in podcast form. I feel like this is also a little bit the writers explaining kind of why would Alan be doing what he's doing? Why would he be doing a podcast at this stage in his career? He says he can't do it on the BBC because there's too many producers, too much compliance issues involved. He can't do it on North Norfolk Digital because he's left under a bit of a cloud. And there's a great bit of fun here because he clearly wants to elaborate, give his side of the story. But I'm guessing he's been given legal advice. So he just sort of says, you know, I left under a bit of a cloud. But there are different types of clouds. A cloud doesn't get shoved for no reason. And I thought at this point, he's clearly going to elaborate anyway at some point.
Now, question on interpretation there. When he says a cloud doesn't get shoved for no reason, is that somebody being shoved out of a company, or is that Alan has shoved somebody in, like, the station or something?
Alan has shoved somebody. I believe it's...
That's what I take it to be referred to
again later on. I think basically he has an altercation with a producer, I think, and pushes them, and then that's where the hot water comes from.
He does push, and he does push Sidekick Simon, remember? In
in a urinal. Matters.
No. He physically pushes him, and he pushes him in your urinal. You're quite right. Yeah. He does push him in Mid Morning Matters.
He is a bit of a shover.
But I think the thing about the radio producer, I think that joke is about basically a radio producer has an argument with him and then has a massive heart attack. I think that was the joke there.
Right. Okay.
So when he says radio producers who scream in my face and then grab their arm and then sit down on a chair and everybody gathers around them. I don't think that's a shoving.
Oh, right, okay. I thought he'd shoved him and then he had the heart attack, but maybe not.
I mean, it could be that. Did you guys also notice that I kind of made a note that he's basically talking about leaving under a bit of a cloud, which means he's left North Norfolk Digital, North Norfolk's best music mix. Does that mean that Mid-Morning Matters Series 3 could not and will not happen? Something to think about.
I suppose it won't. I mean, I guess in terms of the writers and Coogan, I'm not sure that they would return to that now because it feels like they've gone too far beyond it.
They've kind of done it, I guess.
There's been a book and a TV series and now a podcast since that happened. So yeah, I think it's a shame because I think that's some of his best work. But maybe it's quite a limiting format, isn't it? Mid Morning Matters. There's only so much you can do within the walls of a radio studio. Maybe they feel like they've done everything they can. So we cut to, I mean, I don't know if this is really a segment or a new regular feature or an advert. I mean, it seems to exist mainly for the title alone, which is Holmes and Watts On.
That is classic. They've come up with a pun and then worked it backwards, haven't they?
Yeah. So, I mean, effectively, this is like a kind of a sort of Watts On guide to the Norfolk area. But, I mean, it's kind of something and nothing, isn't it?
But it's only two things. Forged in fire, middle-aged men getting together to make swords because they're lonely, and Fob and Firkin, is that it? The debut gig by Tony Mebber, the son of late voiceover artist John Mebber. Did you guys recognise that name?
I did, but I couldn't place it. I googled it to see if it was real. There was something, but I couldn't place
it. It's somebody who exists in the APU. He has been mentioned before, mentioned in Nomad. So this is a direct quote from Nomad. Friend and voiceover artiste John Mebber would love to walk anywhere, let alone to Dungeness, but a recent car crash, from which I'm afraid John was entirely to blame, has put pay to his spine. John now lives in a wheelchair.
Oh, excellent cross-checking there.
Yeah, again, that's the thing. The name really rung a bell, and it took me a while to figure out where it was from, yeah.
So at this point, I think Seldom enters the scene. Bit of barking. And then Alan is talking about some of the corporate films that he's been known for, where he's listing all the mediums that he's tackled before in the context that the podcast is a medium he's yet to tackle. I really enjoyed... They've done this joke before with different titles, but I really enjoy when they reveal the titles of his corporate films that he's done. Yeah. So Be the Best Fire Warden was one, building to the ultimate punchline, which is... I can't remember how he describes it, but I think he says it's the groundbreaking, so you say you've been sexually harassed. Which, the wording of it is so... smart in terms of that you can tell that he's presenting this video from the point of view of a skeptic that doesn't believe the accuser, which is A, awful, and B, absolutely up Alan's street.
I feel like, yeah, in 1990, the video was called So You Say You've Been Sexually Harassed, and in 2020, it's just You've Been Sexually Harassed.
Yeah.
It's also not just that the phrasing of that sentence implies that it's not to be believed, but also it's sort of a kind of light entertainment, you know, it's like So You Think You Can Dance. So you say you've been sexually harassed. He also did the voice of the sat nav for Superbest, Taiwanese tech giants, which I didn't know before and enjoy. I mean, that's absolutely the sort of corporate work you'd expect him to do.
I really enjoyed the kind of subtlety of the joke here, where, you know, they kind of have the phrases like, you know, keep left or turn right in 100 yards, or the get in lane, the kind of like through gritted teeth that thought was a nice, like, kind of like subtle joke.
I think my other little favourite job of his was being the voice in the lift in Great Yarmouth Town Hall as well. I thought that was quite fun.
So specific. Yeah. Who does a voice recording for just one lift?
Alan,
yeah.
Oh, actually, there was in the Royal Festival Hall in London, they had a voice recording of the band Gaggle. So as the lift went up, like a choral kind of chant got louder. And when the lift came down, it got quieter. So
terrifying.
Not quite the same thing. But
that's good.
I was going to say, can we just talk about Alan as a sat-nav voice for a minute? Because I would definitely enjoy a sat-nav in Alan's voice. And I looked into, are you guys aware there are quite a lot of genuine celebrities that have done voice recordings for sat-navs? So TomTom has the following ones available. Brian Blessed, amazing. Billy Connolly, Burt Reynolds, Kim Cattrall, Mr. T, Roger Moore, John Cleese. I also found some other celebs or characters that have done sat-nav voiceovers. Darth Vader, Victor Meldrew, which would be amazing. Eddie Izzard, and I think Snoop Dogg as well. Quite fancy.
I've enjoyed the Snoop Dogg sat-nav on a trip to America before. Our hire car, I discovered with delight, had both Homer Simpson and Snoop Dogg as options.
Amazing. Well, if Snoop Dogg's doing the voiceover, it definitely would be a hire car.
Smoke weed every day.
Oh,
here a week.
Sweet Lord.
Now, I also found, so get ready for a short game here, there are celebrity impressions available for the Garmin sat-nav system. Now, I have to say, I found this afternoon, they are awful. There's a great disclaimer on the website that says all voices are impressions and celebrity names are used for description purposes only. So can we see if you can guess the celebrity voice?
Great.
Nice.
Love it.
All right. Brilliant. Then, so I'm gonna play these out on my phone so you not screen share so you can't see. Okay, so just shout out the name when you think you've got it.
In half a mile, arrive at destination.
It's Alan Rickman, isn't it?
It's Alan Rickman.
Oh, wow.
Well, barely Alan Rickman.
I mean, to be fair, these days you would know that was an impression.
Ahead, turn right, then arrive at destination. How the fuck did you manage that?
Mick Jagger, Ozzy Osbourne.
That's supposed to be Ozzy Osbourne.
Wow.
Okay,
Sharon,
next one.
You've missed a turn.
Proceed to the highlighted route. Okay, let's see if you really can drive.
It's Morgan Freeman.
It's allegedly Morgan Freeman.
I don't know how you got that.
Couple more to go, and these get worse as well. okay.
Proceed to the highlighted route.
Liam Neeson.
Liam Neeson.
And I will kill you. Turn left, then board ferry.
I think the reason a lot of these work is because they have to put in their famous character line so you can understand who they are. Right, this one is mental.
Proceed to the highlighted route.
Oh, that's John Voight. No, not John Voight. Dad's watch. Your
Christopher
Walken.
Nicolas Cage.
Christopher Walken. Yep.
Oh.
Right, we're nearly there. A couple more.
To be honest, if I had to listen to that, I'd rather be Christopher Walken. Here all night.
This one is ridiculous as well.
Keep left, then make a U-turn. You can't handle this car.
Is it supposed to be Tom Cruise?
No, Jack Nicholson.
No, Jack Nicholson from A Few Good Men.
We're going to do three more, okay.
Hey, big boy, let's fucking drive, yes?
Ramsay, Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah.
Turn right, then arrive at destination. Now get in that kitchen, yes?
That is so bad, isn't it? Right, two more.
Shit, do you?
Oh.
Sean Connery.
Proceed to the highlighted route.
Awful. And then my own personal favourite.
Proceed to the highlighted route.
It's a boy seat for horses.
Traffic ahead. For God's sake, we're here all day. I'm recalculating. Lane, find another route. In. That, 3/4 of a mile.
If you'd taken like a wrong turn or something, you'd get really frustrated by that, wouldn't you?
I would say generously, they were getting about 1 in every 5 words in character.
This is brilliant. It did make me think, though, they could quite easily do a cash-in and actually do an Alan Satnav voice, but I'm sure for quality control purposes, Coogan won't do that. But
I also think they're already drenched in audible cash. It's fine.
Oh, absolutely. They're squelchy. However, there must be enough Coogan audio of Alan out there that we could create some Satnav directions. So I'm probably going to regret this, but I'm going to set myself the mission of trying to make some Satnav-style directions before this episode goes out. So we'll drop the results in at the end of the ep.
I can't wait for there to just be a little voice note from you going, I said I'd put some directions in. I haven't done that.
Well, I've always got that as a backup.
So just back to the podcast. Alan talks a little bit about why he'd been resistant to podcasts in the back, a clip I'm sure the four of us particularly enjoyed, where he basically talks down podcasters as... people that live with their mums, spouting their bloated opinions into their USB microphones with a sense of their own self-importance, which is entirely accurate.
Yeah, that script was basically lifted wholesale for the social clip that we shared a couple of weeks ago, where Alan's sitting in a armchair and he basically regales that exact same line. He also says, and I was a little bit disappointed, I'm not going to lie, when he dropped this little nugget, when he said there would be no guests. I was slightly disappointed that at that point I thought, I don't think we're going to hear Lynn. I don't think we're going to hear any other sort of supporting characters. I mean, there is a supporting character which kind of jumps in every now and then and random guest spots. But... the cleaner. But I was a little bit disappointed because I thought at that point, we're not going to get any sort of proper Alan alumni appear in the show.
I was just going to say, Adam, I think the key line that we needed from that podcast debating sequence is people who hosted podcasts were pale, tech-obsessed social lepers who live with their mums. I did spot, though, it's a bit weird, and I don't think it probably means anything, but the line about with their mums, that bit was on the kind of PR version that we've seen, but that is not in the script of this episode. No. So they've edited the mum bashing, as it were.
Okay. notice, at this point, he's halfway through the first episode, he's still establishing the format, explaining his choices. He says that people that don't like this or prefer him on TV or prefer his early stuff are just unhappy people. I feel like this is one of the areas where perhaps Steve Coogan and Alan Partridge dovetail a little bit. I can imagine Steve saying exactly the same thing of people that prefer Alan on TV. He also says Alan's quite sort of rankled about people giving him their opinions when he's at airports. And I thought, in the APU, I doubt that Alan actually uses airports very often, but I bet that's something that happens to Steve Coogan all the time.
I think it's absolutely that, and I love this kind of writing where there's the kind of wonderful dual layer to it, because like you say, this is essentially Coogan and the Gibbons speaking back to critics and fan complaints, but doing it via the character of Alan. So it works on the face value of Alan responding to trolls and critics in the APU, but also Coogan and the Gibbons speaking to real life criticism. And we've seen him do this in response to Alpha Papa negativity in the books, particularly responding to fan base reaction to his hair in that film. I'm sure there's a proper like script writing literary term for the device to explain it a bit more neatly, kind of like using characters as a mouthpiece. I found this word ranisseur, which is defined as a person in a play or a book embodying an author's viewpoint. So that's the closest I've got to it. But yeah, I think the Gibbons and Coogan do this a lot. And I think it's always a lot of fun when you can kind of see the two planes in which it works.
Yeah, it's good value, isn't it? Was anyone surprised to hear that Alan hands out soup to the needy at Christmas? And do we believe him?
Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question.
I suspected it was a cover story, because the reality is I do believe that he spends Christmas alone, but I think the soup angle is a cover story for the fact that he doesn't have anyone to spend Christmas with, rather than it being, you know, a choice that he chooses to give to the needy at Christmas.
Yeah, and I guess he might as well say that, because who could prove him wrong?
that's basically the tagline for all Partridge, right?
I did think that this point where he describes himself as a fiercely private man, I thought, well, one, is he really, when you consider he's done things like had a mock-up version of his house televised? But his reasoning, his evidence for being a private man is because he spent 11 Christmases alone. But I think you go back and go, well, one, that's not by choice. And two, that's not being private. That's just being lonely. It's not the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely that. So he says that he hands up the suit because there's no greater pleasure than seeing a bum smile. And then he has a little chuckle to himself as he imagines what that might sound like to the listener.
Toothy grin.
So back to Seldom, we discover that Alan is recording from the Oast House, not just because it's the title of the show, but because he's physically trapped there by 250-pound brown dog Seldom, who literally, as Alan says, puts the dog into documentary.
250 pounds is 18 stone. I don't think Seldom is 18 stone.
I mean, he does describe him as huge and equivalent to 1.5 men, so at least that stacks up. He also says that he has to take crampons out to walk him. I thought, actually, Tom Dark, you're the proprietor of a very large dog. Do you ever need crampons to take him walking?
Not personally, but I could see scenarios where that could be required. So, yeah, that does seem quite possible, especially if the dog is 18 stone.
Getting him up a slippery hill, for example.
I enjoyed the term "on the warpath" was used in relation to Seldon, and the fact that Alan can't be any more specific than calling him a brown dog, which makes me question how good a dog owner he actually is. I might be hearing things as well here, but I kind of enjoyed that the dog barks don't sound anything better than like a BBC library tape from 1980.
I'd absolutely agree. I think in different scenes, the dog barks don't match up to be the same dog, do they? Yeah.
I've just to jump in quickly, I have gone live to Google to find out what the record is for the world's heaviest dog.
Great research, yeah.
I'm pleased to report that an English Mastiff named Kelly weighed at 294 pounds, which is 21 stone. So it is feasible that Seldom is 18 stone. The English Mastiff was taller than a Shetland pony and more than 6 feet long.
So it's plausible. So the breed, Seldom as a breed is a dog de Bordeaux, also known as a Bordeaux Mastiff or a French Mastiff, and they are known to have be a very powerful dog with a very muscular body. So it does all add up.
Maybe it could.
I mean, are you guys? I think we talked about this very briefly, covering Scissored Isle, in the fact Seldom is a dog de Bordeaux. So that was the breed quite famously featured in Turner and Hooch. If you may remember that film. But I'm pleased to report I found a website called realdogs.com, which gives a breakdown of all different breeds and their cinematic appearances, I should say. So you've also seen a dog de Bordeaux in Payback, the Mel Gibson film noir from 1999, which is
I haven't seen the film Payback.
You should watch it, it's a great film. But I enjoyed the way this website works, is they basically give a star rating to the amount of screen time that the dog breed gets. So Turner and Hooch gets a Bordeaux content 3, whereas there are two other films. There's a film called Dragonheart from 1996.
Oh, great film.
Where it says there's the only a glimpse... Only a glimpse of a Bordeaux, so that gets a Bordeaux content star rating of 1. And a film from 1991 called Eyes of an Angel, starring John Travolta. It says the starring dog is a Doberman, the Bordeaux plays a fighting dog, so that gets a Bordeaux content 1 star as well.
This sounds very similar to a film rating system I devised, where you apply Eddie Murphy heads to a film.
Yes.
Because the more characters Eddie Murphy plays in a film, the worse that film is. So 1 Eddie Murphy head is a very good film. 10 Eddie Murphy heads is Norbit.
Do not watch.
So there's an altercation with a postman and Seldom at this point, which Alan blames on the postman because he's eating a sandwich despite Alan putting up a no sandwich sign. The idea of Alan posting up a no sandwich sign did tickle me a little bit. I didn't have a huge amount else on that other than, for some reason, I've just written Alan has an intercom. That seemed important at the time.
Like choristers, I guess.
Yeah.
The bit that really tickled me was this, that when Alan says, Seldom didn't attack him, but he did manage to pull his trousers off. I just wrote down, lol. The theatre of the mind doing its work. I just found that a really amusing image.
Sorry, go on.
No, you go.
Did anybody notice the fun way that he mangles the name of popular sitcom Are You Being Served?
Yes. Yes.
Really enjoyed
it. Are you
being
served?
Are you being served? Are you being served?
I had noticed in this too, and I was like, I'm not just being mad. Like, he's getting the intonation wrong each time. He stresses the wrong word. So the first time he stresses being, the second time he stresses you. But it's so subtle, and I don't really. There isn't like a payoff or a target to it. Is it just because he hasn't actually seen?
No,
it?
it's just the joke of it being always different, but never correct.
He's doing it from the point of view of it's a weird like such a niche like situation where someone would deliver that sentence that way. That's what makes it so good. I listened to it about 3 or 4 times in a row, and it makes me laugh every single time.
I think you could overthink it, because it could suggest that he hasn't seen the show, or you know, he's talking about something that he doesn't really know, hence he's getting the pronunciation of it wrong because everyone will pronounce it differently. But I think it's really just it sounds funny to mispronounce it, and that is the joke.
Well, I think Adam's nailed it, that it's wrong every time, but it's also different every time. Yeah.
So we get a little bit more flavour now about the nature of the Oast House and how he's ended up there. I mean, effectively, I think this episode is quite largely world building. The first half is explaining why he's doing a podcast, and the second half is explaining why it's from the Oast House. So Denton Abbey, we learn, has 7 bedrooms, and the mortgage was crippling him.
That's not the first time he's been crippled by a mortgage, right?
No, no,
we've heard that before.
Alan says that in Scissor Dial. He says that even though the mortgage of Denton Abbey is crippling him, it's his house and there's nothing anyone can do about it to take it off his hands. Something to that effect.
So I quite like that then. So a few years ago, he's laying out that it is crippling him, and a bit further down the line, it has crippled him and he's had to move out.
He's been forced into a smaller home, which is quite surprising to me, because when I saw the artwork from the Oast House, I actually thought it looked like it had a higher property value than Denton Abbey, but I guess not. Mm. He says Daryl Flench and his friend attended the mortgage meeting. Is there any significance to Daryl Flench? I felt like that's the first time I've heard that name.
No, Daryl Flench is in This Time with Alan Partridge. It's the episode where Alan is a vegetarian, and there's a cut scene where he goes for lunch with some businessmen, and he has chunky chips, Jenga style, and meat-free lilt. And that is basically a meeting with Daryl Flench.
Oh, fantastic.
I didn't have notes on that. I just know that.
Nick, can I just say, well done.
Yeah, no, didn't even have notes. I just remembered that from this time.
We learned that it's not even a real Oast house. It's a replica, which means that he can only legally describe it as an Oast-style house, which is fun. And there's quite a long bit about his fight with his pals at the racket club about what they all get to call their houses. They're all fighting for the best name.
You know, we talked about the fact that Oast houses aren't... was it that they're only found in Kent?
They're not found in Norfolk?
They're called something different in Norfolk. That's the thing, isn't it? They're like houses or something.
Yeah, but that's what I was thinking as well. Does that also tie in... That's quite a nice, neat explainer in terms of it isn't a real Oast house because they don't exist in Norfolk, which is why it has to be Oast style.
We get an advert at this point for Fish Palace in Cromer. Can anyone remember their unique selling point for this ad? An attempt to modernise and keep up with the times?
If you're trying a vegan diet and find it hard to know what to eat, why not consider chips?
I do enjoy that they're experimenting with a vegan gravy as well. Not we have a vegan gravy, our experimental vegan gravy.
I did look into if a Fish Palace existed in Cromer. Sadly not, but TripAdvisor, Alan's favourite site, does tell me that upstairs at number 1 Cromer has the best fish and chips in that town. So if you're in the area, why not give it a try? I just had to say that.
We get a little insight into, kind of into the next episode in a way. We learn that Alan is dating. Mm. He's meeting his date at 11 for brunch because she refused dinner and suggested brunch followed by swimming, which I thought tied nicely back to the accusation from High Noon that he'd been at the local swimming path doing wits, presumably practicing for this date.
Also, I thought, what a weird date. Who would want to eat a brunch and then go swimming? I would not be keen on that.
Yeah, that immediately screams oddball to me. I wondered perhaps if Nick might like to talk about the food delivery system that Alan employs to try and take Seldom from the warpath.
Absolutely. So he uses Rivita as a delivery system, which he slides under a door where he's planed off the bottom to give a centimetre off the door to give Seldom bits of meat. Now, my observations were the following when he said this. it sounds like one, he can't be in the same room as Seldom. Two, if the dog is 18 stone, little bits of meat on a Ryvita pushed under a door are going to take all day to feed a dog like that. Plus, how much Ryvita must he get through? Because the ingress from Seldom's chops means that the matrix system fails very quickly. So he's also caning the Ryvita. I think all of this just paints the picture that Seldom is out of control, but largely because Alan isn't controlling him because he's not a very good owner of dogs.
Was there, did anyone else sort of feel there's a parallel here between the Alan Seldom relationship and the Jim Wilson relationship from Friday Night Dinner? In that effectively, a middle-aged man intimidated by a dog of his own choosing that has become too powerful to control.
Yeah, I think the only difference here is that Wilson is basically at best passive and Seldom is way more aggressive in this situation. Wilson doesn't actually do anything to sort of aggravate, scare or like harm Jim, just stands there.
I did just love what Alan says about the meat delivery system as well, that he uses it to modify, subdue, calm or quell a big cross dog.
I mean, that brings us roughly to the end of the first episode. How did everybody feel at the end of this one? Good to have Alan back, a nice insight into his private life, or a bit waffly and not particularly precise?
I thought this was a very strong opener personally, so it's
agreed.
I mean, it runs fairly like similarly in terms of the running order, and I do think it sets it up nicely. And it's almost like, you know, when you read a book and you kind of have a note from the author before you get into the actual kind of story, it felt very much like the kind of the scene setter, and it's Alan kind of addressing you personally before it gets into kind of the main thrust of it. And even as though we find out the main thrust isn't exactly heavy on the narrative, I thought it was a nice kind of setup, and I thought the gags were consistent and the gags were very funny.
Were we all shocked into silence there, because basically Nick provided a very neat and concise summary and we've got nothing to add?
Pretty much, yeah, that sums it up. Yeah. I think we should move on.
Four years, Nick, and you're finally getting it.
He's hitting his stride, finally.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So for reasons that we've explained at the top of the episode, we're going to skip over episode 2, Ramble, because we've covered it previously, and move straight on to episode 3, Dating, which is very exciting to me because I think, apart from probably the Jill Valentine's Day I'm Alan Partridge scenario, most of Alan's dalliances with women have been marriage-related, or we've already joined him in the middle of a long-term relationship. We've not seen a lot of him on the dating scene, so this is very exciting.
Guys, I just want to say, please carry on recording. I'm just going to jump off the mic and I'm going to prepare something, which I think you'll all agree is a good bit of fun. Back in a second.
Wow, that's exciting. And genuinely, none of us know what he's doing. So,
well, I'm going to make an educated guess here because my opening notes start with Alan's dating outfit, which is a black cashmere polo, black trousers, black boss belt, black shoes. And I've got, in quotes here, looking so Lazenby.
Yep.
Now, the rest of us, Monkey Tennis hosts, I imagine, remember that Tom Stab has previously sported... There he is. Yay. Previously sported the black polo neck, and there it is. Oh. Just a great gag there that, that no listeners can enjoy.
No, it's just for the you guys. Why am I looking so lazy?
Is it because you're dating a woman with four dog grooming parlours?
Yeah, I've donned my black polo neck for this episode especially.
Well, Tom, I've just taken a quick photo of the screen so we can at least share this on socials so everybody can join in the fun.
So, yes, Alan is going on a date with a woman who owns four dog grooming parlours, and I think he says she has more friends than you can shake a soiled stick at, which I guess is a reference to fellow dog walkers and getting sticks to poke your dog muck around.
Pretty much. Can confirm.
I like that they've made it realistic in the APU that obviously one episode in, he could now start to receive feedback and messages from people. So,
well, he's teaming as well by this point.
Yep. So, oh, yes, of course, yeah. So the first one comes from John in Aldershot on Twitter, who says that men put women off by being untidy, unclean or unkempt. And then Alan gives leadership, decisiveness and important jobs as examples of men's things that women are doing quite a good job of.
Did you guys note as well that he mispronounces Aldershot initially? He says Aldershot.
Yeah, he says Aldershot. The Aldershot.
Yeah, I just wondered why they... Yeah.
Well, I think
why they would keep that in.
I think it's Dracula. It's are you being served? It's just I think it's you become a it's become a bit of a trope,
it's
isn't
a
it, in terms of mispronunciation. But someone whose surname is Alder, I can sympathise with John when someone gets their surname wrong and says Alder. Why would it be Alder? It's clearly Alder.
Have you ever had Adler?
Oh, constantly.
Brilliant.
You wouldn't believe it. I get it a lot, basically. And it's
well, I shared a picture with you guys recently on WhatsApp. I reserved a table at a pub, and the name on the piece of paper was Tom Stubb.
Brilliant.
And Tom, don't you often sign off your emails as Tim by accident?
Oh,
as well?
Yeah, always. If you
look, the
I and the O are next to each other on the keyboard. I have signed off emails as thanks or regards, Tim.
Tim.
Yeah. And quite aptly for this podcast, I am frequently called Alan. even when it's got to the point where I have to do a sort of dramatic overpronunciation of my name when booking a table or something, like Adam Brooks. Adam Brooks.
Have you got any identification? Always. My face is my identification.
Alan believes that men should be able to look another man in the eye at the gym and say, I have a personal or grooming regime, what's yours? So question to the group, I have a personal or grooming regime, what's yours?
It depends if I'm going on a date or, you know, if I'm just seeing the lads at the pub, or perhaps I'm going to do the shop in Waitrose or a supermarket of my choosing. It depends where I'm going and what I'm doing. There's essentially a tiering system, and basically the higher up the tier, the more preening it unlocks, including products. It depends what I'm doing.
What would you say was the number of products reserved for the top tier level of grooming?
Top tier, you're talking about a number of it's implements as well, because it's about removing things. Then in the shower, it's a number of products for the body.
Nick, what's the key thing you need to remove?
Well, you know, just want to keep yourself.
Is it nasal hair, perhaps?
It could be. You know, there's nothing wrong with trimming your nasal hair. And I'm happy to look you in the
eye.
I haven't
said wrong. Why have you said wrong?
Or meet you in a gym to discuss how and when I do it.
Does anybody like Alan put the hairdryer on for 6 to 8 minutes before they use it in order to get it to the optimum temperature, followed by a dry lacquer, comb and set?
There's a lot going on, isn't there?
It's nice that he used the words attack the hair as well, as if it's something that needs to be attacked.
Also, you know when he says hot shower, you know that shower is virtually boiling hot as well, isn't it? He's essentially trying to disinfect himself on a daily basis.
And then if he wasn't hot enough, it's 60 press-ups directly before leaving the house so that his arms are bulked up when he meets the lady.
I'm curious as to whether that actually works. Like, does it work?
I feel like that would just make me very sweaty.
Yeah.
Oh no, I've read that action films
work, right?
And things like that, where the action stars will do sort of like press-ups or pull-ups so that... and I also saw the Arnold Schwarzenegger documentary. So they will do like weights before they do photo shoots because it gets the blood pumping and it makes their muscles look bigger and stuff like that. So I think that is a thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the ultimate aim of this whole regime is for him to resemble the milk tray man, which was a lovely throwback to a bygone era.
And all because the lady loves milk tray.
I think the good thing about this as well is that Lynn has called him the milk tray man. So Lynn has given him a bit of banter back after Alan describing her two big tights making her legs like look like two Zebedees. Yeah. So good on you, Lynn.
She also said he looked like a stagehand, though, as well. Yes. So, mixed messages. I thought it was interesting that he talks about how superhero films get on his nerves, but it's quite clear that he's only seen billboards and not actually seen the films. Can you name his four examples of superheroes? I love these. So they get increasingly further from the truth and more ridiculous.
I can start if we want to go around. So we've got Spider Guy.
Can anyone remember the next one?
I mean, I've got all of these if you just want me to do all of them.
Okay. Let's just take it in turns. So the next one is a super cloaked flying guy.
Then you've got a man with claws for fingers and a sword for a head.
Oh, I thought that was two separate ones. I thought it was. I thought you'd have Spider Guy, super cloaked flying guy, man with claws for fingers, which I presume is he's clocked a film poster of Wolverine, and then just sword for a head, which is nothing, is it?
That's just not a thing, and would look.
I don't know. I'd probably watch that. I have to broadly agree with Alan here. I don't really care for Marvel movies. It's not for me.
But like Alan, have you seen them? Because he does admit he's not seen any of them.
I mean, I have seen maybe three. So I've made an informed decision that it's
enough to know. Yeah. You've done your research.
Exactly.
A rare bit of humility from Alan where he stresses that he is too old to play Bond. I think that's the sort of thing that a previous Alan would never have admitted.
That's a very good point. And when he talks about his heroes being the Milk Tray Man and George Lazenby as Bond, I did think, from what I know, isn't George Lazenby widely regarded as the worst Bond ever? So I think it's Alan's perhaps kind of missing the target a little bit there. And I did look into this and I found a website giving the definitive ranking of James Bond actors. And I enjoyed this little paragraph on George Lazenby. The burly Australian barged into the franchise for film number 6, made a real meal of it and then exited again. True, on Her Majesty's Secret Service, has gained something of a cult following over time and showed us a vulnerable, more emotional and Daniel Craig-like Bond well before its time. But was George Lazenby the right man to bring this vision to life? No, he was not.
That is very much the film criticism equivalent of the car becoming overtaking vehicles becoming a long, drawn-out affair.
Yes, it is, isn't it? Yeah.
Lazenby not getting the great reviews. I also liked that he claims that Alan Sugar can't be Bond because he's Jewish, which, I mean, I didn't realise that was a prerequisite, but okay.
It was also just good to hear of Amstrad again and to know that Alan was witness to the Amstrad Employee of the Year at the Birmingham NEC. The Birmingham NEC.
Maybe that's how he got his free emailer phone as seen in the Saturday Night. Yeah.
There's a nice bit of insight into Alan's dating past. We learned that after Carol, he dated a woman called Hazel. They named each other after various milk tray products. She signed a card to a businessman from both of them as Fudge Duet, and the businessman turned up thinking it was an invite to a threesome wearing a Hawaiian shirt. This upset Alan so much, he dumped her, but crucially, he dumped her between Christmas Day and New Year. The classiest time of year.
Yeah.
Although I did enjoy the description that she had a birthmark like a vortex.
on the grooming regime as well, are we to believe that he seems to claim that both him and his date are hairless besides dog hair? Now,
well, I don't know if you're about to make the same point that I'm about to make, but he talks about having hair around his nipples like crop circles.
Yeah, that comes in a later episode, doesn't it? So I think he says he's resorted to just shaving his chest.
He also talks in I'm Alan Partridge about having a ring of hair around each nipple. So
I think perhaps he's become more hairless over time by choice.
Or he just shaves everything.
Well, I think that's the implication,
yeah.
Which I just thought my note was basically too much information. Alan did not need that image.
I wouldn't have had Alan down as a ball shaver, to be honest with you, either. That caught me by surprise.
He didn't break that down in his grooming regime earlier in the episode either. So, thankfully, probably for the best.
So he goes into a little detail about how he came to be on this date. It's primarily through a high-class dating site called Echelon, run by Wilf and Fee, who get to know you and present a tightly curated list of matches. He seemed to be quite impressed with the service. He felt several of them work, although his evidence for that was that he had a relationship for a year where he didn't have sex once. So again,
I did wonder, is the implication here that Alan has inadvertently signed up to some kind of escort agency?
Essentially. Possibly.
So perhaps that's why it's been a 12-month sexless relationship, because perhaps he doesn't realize he has to pay the top tier to get access to
I'd taken it at face value and thought it was just like a kind of elite singles. But yeah, the fact he was in a relationship for a year and didn't have sex does tend to suggest maybe you're right.
I don't know. I might be adding 2 to 2 and making 7 at this point. I'm not sure, but yeah.
I did find that section a little bit confusing, though, where he was saying it was sexless, but they seemed to be enjoying each other's company. And then he talks about seeing when they go walking, and they put kind of their hands down each other's trousers, and then she goes home and makes him a beef paste sandwich. I just thought, I don't understand the need for the hands down the trousers if it's sexless. I just thought it was a bit confusing.
Yeah, I did love the mention of the biggest beef paste sandwich you've ever seen. That reminded me of the bit in Nomad when he says, adrenaline's flying around my body like it used to when Angela said she's made one of her chicken pies.
It sounds like it's a beef paste sandwich so compelling that it's carried him through a sexless year of dating. So it must have been good. He also explains why he won't do Tinder. It's because people just want to make fun of him, and he's hurt by people that keep turning away when he tries to kiss them. He sounds genuinely distressed at this point.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
He mentions, he must have been dating for a while, because he mentions he has a page of talking points and practiced ad-libs that he likes to do.
Practiced ad-libs. Brilliant.
And then I think we're on to possibly one of the biggest gaffes of Alan's this series. Not entirely his fault, the huge backfiring of his Stevie Wonder joke.
the kind of conceit of this, I thought, was fairly well conceived in terms of in a real life situation where you to make this joke, yeah. It works quite well. And as Alan kind of acknowledges, it does rely on the recipient having a working knowledge of the person that's being referenced, whether it be kind of Genghis Khan, Oliver Cromwell, or Stevie Wonder. And obviously, in the instances that Alan references, the individual doesn't have that information.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually, because I think at the top of the episode, Alan sets out that he's going to tell us, the listener, how to find love and how to make a date go swimmingly. So I did wonder whether we should review if he succeeds in his mission by the end of this episode. And actually, this icebreaker technique is quite good in terms of having a few different names you could just drop in depending on what scenario you're in. So actually, well done, Alan.
Although a lot of the names that he uses in these jokes, Oliver Cromwell, Stevie Wonder, etc., are household names. So the fact that these jokes are falling flat when he's been paired with people from a high wealth or high class dating site, I think it tells you a lot about the hollow pyramid scheme that Echelon actually is. And it sounds like it might actually be populated with middle class thickos that think that they're high class. He does start to give the some of the tips that he mentioned he would at the top of the episode. He recommends asking some questions if conversation dries up. And I love these because they're so telling. There's so much meaning in these that he hasn't realized. So for example, he says, if she has a beautiful necklace, ask who bought it for her. Kind of like, is he trying to establish whether there's a love rival, or he's kind of like also is it just saying that he can't believe that a woman could be successful enough to buy her own expensive jewelry?
I think it is ultimately that, but he talks about three things. You've mentioned one of them. The other two are if the person has, for example, a strong Roman nose. Say, I like your strong Roman nose, which I would imagine if you have a strong Roman nose, you probably don't want it pointed out. And then he talks about hooped earrings, where he's saying, finger them. Not only is the term finger them slightly unpleasant, but also I imagine most people don't want you leaning across and touching their earrings. So all three of those pieces of advice, I would say, don't follow.
To be clear, I wasn't saying all his advice was good.
There's another piece of advice which I definitely wouldn't follow, which is and also, if you're going for a date with Alan, he's probably going to say something bad. This is probably going to happen. And he's like, don't feel the silence. It's their silence, not yours.
Yeah, playing hardball. There's actually two more questions that he suggests asking. Remember, these are questions to ask only if conversation has already dried up. one of them is that your natural tan or some tinted concealer? But I think my absolute favourite, and the one with the most subtext, is, bearing in mind, remember, this is a question to ask if conversation's dried up. Imagine you're probably going to have to be about 20 minutes into the date before that happens. The question is, are you going to take that coat off? Presumably, he's on a date with someone who has realised that they've backed into a minefield, desperately wants to go, refuses to take their coat off, and has got to the point where conversation's been going long enough to dry up, and he's still asking them if they're going to take their coat off and stay or not.
The next bit as well, then, he's perplexed by somebody asking the question, what are you up to in life? when he's saying, how do you answer that? I mean, if he's struggling to answer what he's generally doing in life, it's not going to be a good date, is it?
No, it's like he can't handle an open question.
Yes,
no.
Exactly.
Yeah,
he perceives it to be bad because it lacks in specifics. So what he says he does in response is to ask something very specific, i.e. where were you on this day at this time?
like a criminal investigation. Yeah. A lot of his chat as well seems to be about tricking women into a second date. So before they realise it, he's backed them into a corner and they've had to say yes.
Before they know it, he's invited himself on a trip to Northumberland to get a book out of a library or to visit a car.
Well, you're both going there, so why not?
Well, yeah, quite.
I think there's an advert now for a few other podcasts that Alan hasn't necessarily listened to, but recommends nonetheless. So Saddle Stories.
Can I, before you describe Saddle Stories, I just want to remind you that Alan says prior to this that he's going to talk about some podcasts that are knocking it out of the park. And then he goes on to describe Saddle Stories, which I'll hand back to you, Adam.
Sure. So it's hosted by Norfolk Lady Riders. And he says that it's not for him, but it's very popular with ladies over 40. How do you solve a problem like Ireland? It's another one that he
What
likes.
Do you do about Ireland? How do you separate the good ones from the bad ones? And they speak to an Irish person who's very nice.
And is it too easy for some Irish people to travel? with a suggestion that you could stop ferries but allow air travel, the subtext there being keep the poor Irish people in Ireland but let the people who can afford to fly come and visit. And
does he not say sort the wheat from the chaff or something like that at that point?
Yes, he does.
I do like that the kind of like voices of authority on the podcasts are newspaper columnists who are from England. That's definitely the way to have a balanced debate about it.
And his final podcast suggestion with an exclamation mark after it is Recall, the 1973 recall of the Triumph Toledo, a 12-part series narrated by John Stapleton.
I like with the Irish one, I feel like Coogan's one of the few English comedians that can get away with that. They're like the kind of negative Irish stereotyping because we all know he's got Irish roots. I think other people might struggle. So I think, you know, even like the Martin Brennan character in this time was very well received in Ireland. And I think just an English comedian with no Irish roots doing stuff like that probably wouldn't go down quite so well.
Absolutely. Is it time to talk about Alan's aftershave?
Oh, please.
Robust.
Oh, I think it is, yeah.
Which he designed himself. Now, I like when he says designed himself, I mean, obviously, the average listener to this will know that there are all sorts of companies now where you can go in and kind of pick your top notes and blend flavours and genuinely create your own one. But it emerges that actually what he does is he mixes Dupe, Davidoff, M&S, a Molton Brown miniature and any magazine freebies that he's got to hand, finishing it off with a tiny sprinkling of powdered white pepper to create his own blend called Robust.
This is basically the equivalent of like a student at the end of a house party, isn't it? Like seeing what booze is left in the house and just putting it all into one glass and drinking it.
Absolutely the dirty pint of aftershaves.
I wonder what it would actually smell like if you combined all those ingredients.
I don't
Not
think
good,
it'd be great.
I would think.
No. And also, you know, he is absolutely slathering that on as well, isn't it? It's not just a couple of sprays. He is absolutely bathing in that before he goes out.
It very much reminds me of, I do like a comedy name for perfume, and it always reminded me of, do you remember Horn from Men Behaving Badly? Tony's Choice.
Which is also kind of a bit like a Sex Panther in Anchorman as well, isn't it? That sort of
Yeah. Oh, and any of the fragrances dreamed up by Dennis Feinstein in Parks and Recreation as well.
Yeah, great.
It's the comedy goldmine, the scent arena. I also like the little tidbit of him talking about how he likes to dip into GQ, which is a magazine, he says, for guys who need to look good and think about stuff, but not too much.
Yeah. Again, is that kind of like the writers talking through using Alan as a mouthpiece to have a bit of a dig at GQ as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Did you enjoy him going into a kind of voiceover mode? Like at the end of episode one, when he runs away from Seldom, gets into the car, he's then saying, you've been listening to Alan Partridge live. Well, not live. He's kind of gone into broadcast mode at the end of that episode as well. And the same thing kind of happens here.
We promised an update on the date coming in the next episode from the Oast House. And I think that kind of rounds things off, doesn't it? Unless there's anything to add.
I just have one more thing. There's a bit when he's having an argument with a real pen-pushing anorak about building regulations at the Oast House. And I just thought, that doesn't really make sense. He's saying he's had to move out of Denton Abbey because he was financially crippled. But the way he talks about this is like he's built the Oast House from scratch, which surely would not be something cheap.
So
whether that's a narrative inconsistency or just an unreliable narrator, we don't know.
That sounds like a narrative inconsistency to me. That's where I put my money.
Yeah, and you've also got the bit there when he's basically agreeing with Michael Gove saying people are tired of experts, which I think is another very clear example of what we've termed in the past, Alan yes, Coogan no.
Yep. Absolutely. So, yeah, that rounds us off the end of Alan's dating exploits for the time being. Join us in our next episode. We're all going to Lynn's house.
Yay!
if you want to get in touch with us with any conspiracy theories, jokes, quizzes, polls, questions to the group, or theories or thoughts about this series or any Partridge, we're on Instagram at Monkey Tennis Pod, Twitter at The Partridge Pod, Facebook.com/The Partridge Pod, ThePartridgePod@gmail.com, and the WhatsApp voice notes. You can leave them for us on the Monkey Tennis Hotline. 07923 600 017.
And can I just add, when Adam says conspiracy theories, not general conspiracy theories, it must be Alan related. We don't want to hear about coronavirus and 5G.
Jed.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, Jed. And enough of that. Stop messaging us.
Something I probably should have mentioned at the top of the episode. Welcome to all of you who searched on a podcast provider for From the Oast House, expecting to find Steve Coogan's dulcet tones and finding us, Dan and Lashids, instead. Obviously, From the Oast House, the official Alan Partridge podcast, is an Audible original. So you've got to go to Audible and start a free trial or sign up to access it. But frankly, I'd be amazed that any of you have got this far without having listened to the source material. So, so hopefully we're all on board and you can join us next week for a fun trip to Lynn's house. But from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge Fan Podcast, thanks so much for listening and goodbye.
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 I'm going to go eat some milk tray, I think.
In 200 yards, turn right, then take the second left. In 100 yards, turn left. Get in lane. Speed camera ahead. In 200 yards, at the roundabout, take the third exit. Turn left, then you have reached your destination.
And this is the beauty of podcasting, the freedom of the medium.
Kukumpa.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring!
Fireworks. Dumma kebab.
Trees are my pawn.
Monkey tennis?
Ready, steady, fuck off.
Scratch me!
Are you being served?
Monkey tennis?
Excuse me, your dog's taken my dog's stick.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
Monkey tennis?
Yup-salutely, yup-yup-yup-salutely.
Generally, I think new ideas are bad.
Monkey tennis?
Why not consider chips?
You must come and stay in the barn.
Fuck off.
Riddle me that, you nutters. Nothing refreshes like an ice-cold glass of milk.
Nah.
Monkey tennis?
From the Oast House.
Keep it down, love.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.